You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show, and my guest is Dr. Paul Offit, whose latest book, Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. Paul Offit is the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's written many other books, and he is a critique of the vitamins and supplement industry, and talks about our vulnerability to quackery. Welcome to the show. Sorry about it being called The Brian Callen Show. I just ran out of ideas, and I said, let's just call it my name.
Sounds good, Brian. I'm in.
Yeah, there you go. You know, I read Bad Science by Ben Goldacre. I don't know if you read it. But
I did, yeah.
Yeah, and I read Denialism as well. What I didn't know about your book kind of touches on, you know, living in California and Los Angeles, it's amazing. I don't think I know anybody who doesn't take antioxidants and supplements. I stopped taking them about 10 years ago because I did my own reading and realized that you probably can get it seems to me that despite all the evidence, you know, despite all sort of the industry out there that says that we can prolong your life and we can make you healthier and stronger, nothing really improves on sleep, water, and whole nutritious food. I mean, and lack of stress.
I agree. So I mean, if there are studies that have been done that are reasonable that show that if you eat diets rich in fruits and vegetables, that you tend to have lesser risk of cancer and lesser risk of heart disease. So then the question becomes, what is it about those fruits and vegetables that seems to help? And the most likely bet is antioxidants. So antioxidants are good. That's true. The question then became, is more better? In other words, if you take supplemental antioxidants, you know, much greater quantities than you would ever get in food, is that good for you, the same, or bad for you? And the answer is clear and consistent. It's bad for you. I mean, you can actually tip the balance of oxidation, antioxidation, too much in favor of antioxidation. And you need oxidation for certain things, like, you know, killing new cancer cells, which probably happens more frequently than we'd like. So the industry, the industry that tells you that if I take large quantities of supplements, concentrate them in a pill, and you take them by mouth, that's actually as good, if not better, for you than eating fruits and vegetables is wrong.
Right. That was what was amazing. And in the book, you also touch on, you know, Orrin Hatch in Utah and the lobbying effort by the vitamin industry. What you hear over and over, at least where I spend my time in California and things, is, well, the pharmaceutical industry, you know, and the medical industry is, you know, basically has really strong lobbying efforts, and they don't want you to know about these cures, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in fact, it, according to your book, the vitamin industry has very strong lobbying circles and puts a lot of effort into essentially keeping any negative press about vitamins suppressed.
Yeah, you know, it's remarkable, actually, how they've been able to sell themselves. First of all, it's a $34 billion a year industry, so it's massive. And with that kind of money,
$34 billion. We should just take a minute for the listeners. A million seconds, about 11 days. A billion seconds is roughly 33 years. So it's a $34 billion. So that's $34 billion. I just like to kind of – that's crazy to me.
And with that kind of money comes advertising dollars and influence, specifically political influence. So if you – what's amazing to me is they sell themselves, it's all natural, it's all good, it can only help, it can't possibly hurt. You know, we're just, you know, elves and old hippies making these products on flowering meadowsides. The truth of the matter is, this is big pharma. This is big pharma that's not regulated. Pfizer bought Alacer. They're a major maker of megavitamins in the United States. Huffman La Roche has been in this business since the 1930s. I don't get it. I mean, I don't get how amazingly susceptible we are to this kind of advertising. It's a drug, just like any other drug, and frankly, it should be regulated as a drug. That way, at least the consumer knows what they're getting.
I agree. The one thing that I think is human beings have always been in love with immortality. I mean, that is what drives us. Everybody wants to live forever. And you talk about this. There have always been hucksters. There have always been snake oil salesmen. What I think is fascinating is that in 2014, with the exponential growth in biotech and in our understanding of the human body and the genome, et cetera, we are still, that snake oil is still a thriving industry. It just is.
And always will be. I think the last man to comment on this industry will be the last man on earth. I just think we're susceptible to this kind of notion of magic. I mean, hence the title of the book. Do you believe in magic? The answer is yes, we believe in magic.
Very much so. What I find heartbreaking was that story, the chapter on Hofbauer. I can't remember his name. The boy.
That's it, John Hofbauer, yeah.
John Hofbauer, when he had Hodgkin's lymphoma, or it's non-Hodgkin's, whatever it is, but it was curable. And Laetrile, this apricot seed extract, was given to him and his parents. I know a lot of parents that don't, that believe in this stuff. They don't immunize their children. So what happens is children lose their herd immunity. My child now is at risk. And I just feel like I wish these people would pick up a history book. That's what I wish they'd do. Just take a look. If you read any, even literature, I mean, it could be Dickens or anything. What is prevalent? The fact that people were always dying of consumption and fever. I mean, I think Lincoln lost three of his children to typhus and diphtheria. You know, to whatever the fevers were, they didn't know. They just knew that, oh, there's my son at 11 years old and he dies. You were always burying your children. And thanks to antibiotics and thanks to vaccines, we don't have to deal with that anymore. That's a very rare occurrence, thank God. And it bothers me that the people that, you know, Jenner and the people that came up with these things don't get the credit they deserve. We just benefit from them and have no idea, you know, we don't pay homage to those scientists and to the people that have pushed us so far beyond our biology.
Yeah, I think probably the contrast you can make is that, you know, when Jonas Salk made his vaccine to prevent polio, he was hailed as a hero. I mean, he was given ticker tape parades down the center of New York City. At last, we had a vaccine to prevent us from a disease that, you know, that caused probably as many as 50,000 people to be paralyzed and, again, a few thousand to be killed. Now we have, for example, a human papillomavirus vaccine. Human papillomavirus causes cancer. It causes about 26,000 cases of cancer a year in the United States, about 18,000 in women and about 8,000 in men. You now have a cancer-preventing vaccine that will stop all this, and yet it's sort of vilified. I don't get it. I really don't get why it is that it's not even just scientific illiteracy. I think it's more like scientific denialism.
But you talk about it in the book, and I'd never thought of this. You give a very good perspective on it, and that is that alternative medicine kind of stays the same. It's ancient, right? So acupuncture, etc., these are ancient. They've been that way forever. And modern science is always changing because it's always trying to improve on itself. It's always looking at data. It's always questioning itself. And there's something very reassuring about something that's been around forever that doesn't move. Isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. I would argue there's no such thing as alternative medicine. I think if an alternative medicine works, then it's medicine. And if an alternative medicine doesn't work, then it's not an alternative. It's all testable. The notion of this sort of parallel universe of medicine, which is, you know, all natural and ancient and can only help us, is just marketing.
That's right. I love the way you put that in the book, too. You basically say that there's medicine that works and there's medicine that doesn't work. And you can test for that. You can test for that. You can do double-blind studies. The first thing everybody should ask when they're taking a pill and somebody's giving it to them, a supplement, where are the double-blind studies? Let me see the data. Is there any data or is it all hearsay? And it's always just hearsay, right?
Agreed. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And it's painful. You know, it's... You know, I'll give you an example. I was on Science Friday with Ira Flatow a number of months ago, and there was a woman who called in from Chicago who said that she was angry. She was angry at the pharmaceutical company that the fact that the FDA had recently licensed Paxatil, in other words, Paxil is the trade name, to sort of lessen the number of hot flashes that a woman would have to suffer during menopause. But the numbers weren't convincing. It was like it went from 5.5 to 4 hot flashes per episode. And her feeling was, why did this ever get licensed? I mean, I just think it's terrible. Paxatil or Paxil also has problems with suicide ideation. I can't believe they licensed it. Instead, I'm going to take black cohosh. And you know, what's interesting to me about that is because Paxil is licensed, at least you know what the data were. And you can say, that's not enough for me. And the risks outweigh the benefit. Fair enough. But black cohosh has never really been formally studied. A couple of these preparations were taken off the market recently, you know, because there were problems with it. And so she sort of likes the black box because it's an unknown. Whereas, you know, the known was, you know, was less attractive to her.
I just think that we need more people like you. Science has got to do a better job of being more aggressive in arguing for its point of view and arguing for how detrimental these people are. I happen to think that the people that are – somebody wanted to sponsor this podcast. They had a supplement. And they wanted to pay me some real money. And the first thing I said was, fine, but I got to see the data. Do you have any double-blind studies? I need to see peer-reviewed, you know, studies on this. And if it really works, then that's fine. Well, of course, they didn't have any of that. I just think that the people that are making these vitamins and the people that are the guy, whoever, whatever his name was, who's pushing Laetril, et cetera, I think they're bad people. I think they're criminals. I think that they're probably sociopaths. And I think that they are complicit. And I'll make a distinction here. I think they're complicit in the deaths of this poor kid like Hofbauer. It's one thing to be ignorant. It's one thing when Jenny McCarthy, I've always said, Jenny McCarthy, I've met a couple times. I know people that know her. Jenny's not a bad person. My problem with Jenny is that she was ignorant. Jenny was doing whatever she could to save her kid. She got caught up in the wrong. People were telling her the wrong things. She's not that educated, and she was a desperate mother trying to fix her child. Now, the people I fault are the people dumb enough to follow what Jenny McCarthy has to say. But then again, when you have people like Oprah giving her a mouthpiece, when you have Oprah saying things like she wrote a book, she knows what she's talking about, this is where it causes real damage, right?
I agree. I mean, it continues to amaze me how we believe that because somebody, you know, co-wrote the movie Dirty Love with Carmen Electra, that gives her sort of credence with regard to the cause or causes of autism. It is remarkable. And we're even, just take another step, she's the mother of a child with autism, and therefore that makes her an expert on autism. That's not true. It makes her an expert on her child. But we give her that leeway and are perfectly willing to follow someone who obviously doesn't know the data. If she knew the data, she would never say what she says and follow her blindly over the cliff. You know, you're seeing outbreaks now, measles and mumps and pertussis or whooping cough and bacterial meningitis, in large part because people are making choices, because in part they're influenced by people like Jenny McCarthy. It's sad.
Well, this is where legislation could come in. I'm not a big fan of government regulation and legislation and things like that, but I do think that if you want to go to a school and you're not vaccinating your child, you're putting my child at risk. And if all the data and all the scientific evidence supports my point of view, then I think you shouldn't be allowed to go to school unless you vaccinate your child.
I think we're at a tipping point, actually. I mean, you know, for the last few years, we've had, you know, maybe 150, 170 cases of measles a year. Last year was 189. This year, we had 106 cases through the end of March. So that's a rate of 400. Now we're moving up. And look at what's going on in Canada, where they have rates of disease that are much greater than us, and they're our neighbor. If you get to about 600-700 cases of measles in this country, you're going to start to see children die of measles. And then I think the conversation is going to change. You're going to start to see people saying, you know, my child, you know, is at risk because of what you're doing, and I'm not going to accept it. And I think I agree with you. You'd like to think that one could simply persuade people to do the right thing with good evidence, but that doesn't seem to work. I think, you know, ultimately, if that doesn't work and people are suffering that, then you have to coerce them.
I agree 100%. This is worth fighting for, is what it is. This is we're fighting nonsense, and we're fighting magic. And I thought we went through this. I love in the book you there's a quote, and I can't remember where really from Alexander the Great. I mean, George Washington died of bloodletting. He died from bloodletting, which I didn't know, and we really had learned nothing. Very little from you know, Alexander Great until you know, at the point George Washington had died. It's a little bit like the massive jump when Morse finally invented Morse code, the telegraph. The difference, the massive jump in how we were able to communicate. I mean, people, Alexander the Great had to get a message to people in the same exact way that, you know, people did 3,000 years later or 2,000 years later, by horse, by boat, or by foot. And then all of a sudden the telegraph comes along. And I just feel like it's amazing to me. It's amazing that we are regressing, that we are devolving in certain segments of the population. And maybe it's because people aren't dying. Maybe it's because, you know, we have short memories.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question, and I'm sure it's broader than my expertise. But, you know, we certainly live longer than we did. I mean, and if you compare 1900 to 2000, we live 30 years longer. Why? Because of science. That's why. It's because we've learned to, because of vaccines, because we purify the drinking water. There's a number of reasons, but probably vaccines are probably the most important. So science has caused us to live longer lives, but it doesn't necessarily cause us to live more meaningful lives. And I think that's maybe where people get put off. They think, you know, that they start to at some level fear science and say, okay, I'm going to, you know, to grab onto something else. And you know, if you look in this country, there seems to be more and more polarization for people that are, say, more fundamentalist on one hand, and then who reject the existence of a supreme being on the other hand. That also is both are sort of growing phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we're embraced both poles because at some level we're dissatisfied.
Yeah, I think so. I think part of it just is human beings have such a need, you know, to be in control of their own sovereignty. I mean,
yeah, or to see something greater than ourselves. And
yeah.
I think, you know, science is all very understandable. It's all testable. I mean, you're not asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here. You're asking, does black cohosh treat menopause? You can answer those questions. You know, and there's something, I think that's where people like Mehmet Oz, Deepak Chopra, and Andrew Weil succeed, is they have this sort of mystical sense about them. It's almost guru sense. It's religious in many ways. And I think that's what people like.
Yeah, 100%. I think you hit it too. People do like to reach beyond themselves. I mean, that seems to be so human. We have a nostalgia to kind of try to explain the unexplainable. For example, when somebody diagnoses a child with a terminal disease, that's a terrible, terrible thing to be confronted with. And it just seems so unfair. And most of us have a contract with life. If I do the right thing, good things will happen to me. And then when something crazy like that happens, you don't have it. You of course, you're going to go to Mexico or anywhere and give them whatever. I think you even talk in the book, even when you don't believe it, even when you know it doesn't work, you're going to try it anyway. So part of this stuff is born out of desperation, maybe when medical science says to you, guess what, you got 2 months to live and there's nothing we can do about it. You know, my buddy died of pancreatic cancer, and I remember the doctor said, look, chemo doesn't work with this. You're at stage four. This is a bad situation. You got to get your things in order. He was 43. He didn't want to leave his kids behind. He started taking mushrooms, different kinds of medical mushrooms. He was doing whatever he could. So maybe a lot of it's born out of that sort of, when you have no answers, you start reaching for, I guess, things that are way more ethereal.
Yeah, and I think also that to me is quackery at its worst. I think that those people, and I talk about a few in the book, who take patients who have diseases like, you know, metastatic pancreatic cancer or brainstem gliomas or glioblastomas, you know, brain tumors, that for which medicine has clearly not caught up, and they offer something greater, right? Even though modern medicine can't do this, I can do this. I can help you at, you know, a cost of tens of thousands of dollars. I honestly think that is quackery at its worst, and we're very bad at cracking down on that.
Well, because those people are sociopaths. I would put them in jail. There's nothing that makes me angrier. But what do you think? Give us some ammunition. I mean, what is the best way to argue with somebody who is sort of enamored with this kind of, you know, again, I have to tell you, my neighbor died. She was in an acting class of mine. She was 33 at the time. She got an infection. She went systemic, and she was an herbalist was keeping her away from antibiotics, and she died. She died. I remember looking at her. I said, her gums were bleeding. I said, you got to get her to an infectious disease doctor or something right away. And he said, no, our herbalist told us if she went to a hospital, she'd be dead in 24 hours because there's so many diseases. Oh, okay. There you go. And she died. So you see this kind of stuff. What is the best way? Should I just throw your book in their face? I mean, you just want people to read. You know, I know people who are currently making a lot of money selling vitamins, okay? And they're good guys. They're not bad people. They just are ignorant. And today, in fact, I'm going to go see one of them, and I'm going to read from you know, one of your chapters on the enormous evidence. Let's talk a little bit about the enormous evidence, and this is from many different countries, the enormous evidence that suggests that supplements, vitamins, antioxidants are actually increase your risk for cancer markedly and heart disease. I mean, talk about some of these studies, because they're all over the place. It's not just...
Yeah, no, I think if you had to pick a vitamin supplement that clearly increases your risk of cancer, it's vitamin E and prostate cancer. And so people think, you know, this is great. Vitamins are good, and they are good. I mean, you need vitamins to live. Generally, you get what you need in food. And so people think, well, you know, maybe my diet's not good enough. I'll take a multivitamin, which is fine. I don't think you need it, but it certainly isn't likely to hurt you. It's when you get into the mega vitamin category. And so my wife and I walked into a GNC center a few months ago and asked for, you know, what they had and that could help with heart health. And the 25-year-old behind the counter said, you know, what you need is vitamin E. So we went and picked up the bottle. And, you know, on the back of it, it says vitamin E, natural 1,000. And then you see in the label, it says that it's 33,333% of the recommended daily allowance. That's 33 times the recommended daily allowance. If you open up the bottle and pull out what's inside, it's a gel cap that's brown, that's maybe half the size of an almond. Almonds are an excellent source of vitamin E. You would have to eat 1,650 almonds to get what's in that one gel cap.
Wow.
Begging the question, why is the word natural on that bottle? There is nothing natural about eating 1,650 almonds. What amazes me is nowhere on that bottle does it say that this increases your risk of prostate cancer, because the data could not be clearer. And I don't, for all the crap that personal injury lawyers bring to this country in terms of lawsuits, where is that lawsuit? I mean, nowhere on that bottle does it say that this increases your risk of prostate cancer. Failure to warn. The data are certainly there.
I hope there are lawyers listening to this, because you would then be able to, and you can actually draw a correlation. There is data to suggest that massive doses of vitamin E cause prostate cancer.
Right.
Wow. That's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And the same can be said about antioxidants.
Yeah, and vitamin E is an antioxidant, as are, you know, omega-3 fatty acids, you know, beta-carotene, which is vitamin A precursor, vitamin A. There's a number of things. Antioxidants, I don't, you know.
Oh, so oils, so omega-3s are also antioxidants.
Yes, they
What else is? Beta-carotene, vitamin E, omega-3s.
Those are the big ones, vitamin A, beta-carotene. Selenium is a mineral, yeah.
Okay.
But you know, just, I guess you alluded to earlier, you know, what can one say? I would say buyer beware. You know, just don't give, you know, I think you should be skeptical of anything you put into your body, but not cynical, skeptical. And,
yeah.
And so you should try and find evidence. Now it's hard, because certainly in the dietary supplement industry, when there's 54,000 dietary supplements on the market roughly, you know, because it's not FDA regulated, you don't have those data. So I think the best you can hope for is to try and find experts, you know, who at least know the data that are there, because otherwise you're just going to be reading banner ads and listening to celebrities and thinking that's information.
Talk about the lobbying efforts and how the vitamin industry was able to keep any kind of regulation at bay and continues to.
Right. What happened, actually, I think the key moment occurred there were two key moments. One in the mid-1970s, when the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, wanted to regulate mega vitamins. They were worried about vitamins being sold at more than 150% of the recommended daily allowance, and they wanted to regulate it. And at the time, Bill Proxmire, who was a Democrat from Wisconsin, who sort of headed a bill where he was going to basically keep the FDA at bay. And you know, when you have an industry that at that time was making, you know, probably $750 million to $1 billion a year, there was influence. And they were able to basically make it so the FDA could not regulate megavitamins. The key moment came in the early 1990s when David Kessler, who was head of the FDA, said, I'm worried that people are walking into health food stores getting advice from that 25-year-old behind the counter that may not be good. They're getting advice on how to treat their infections, how to lower their blood pressure, how to treat their cancer, how to, you know, to help with heart disease. And there are no data. So what I want to do is I want to create a bill that basically says that these dietary supplements can't make claims unless it's supported by data. And if it's not, then it's fraud. That scared the industry. And so that was when Orrin Hatch and others came in to sort of basically, again, put a stake in the heart of the FDA and keep them at bay through something called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which, you know, the upside down world of this industry has nothing to do with education and everything to do with the consumer. Consumer not knowing what they're buying. And so now you have a protected industry that doesn't have to admit its claims or either support its claims or admit its harms.
Unbelievable.
And actually, my favorite was the New York Times. When the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act was passed, they called it the Snake Oil Protection Act, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And yet it continues, and yet it just seems like it's almost like, talk about a cause. This is a real cause. This is something that like lawyers and good people could sink their teeth into. Because, you know, I mean, it sounds to me like this industry is doing actual harm to people's health.
Yeah, look, I mean, the FDA pulled 42 dietary supplements off the market last year. And this is the tip of the iceberg. Why? Because they were found to be contaminated with other pharmaceutical products. I mean, Such is the nature of, and including deaths. I mean, that OxyElite Pro story in Hawaii where people died of liver disease. You know, I have become so scared of walking into, you know, a pharmaceutical, you know, store or, you know, or
Rite Aid,
you know, and pull these things off the market because you don't know what's in them. Because it's unregulated. You can put a dietary supplement on the market tomorrow. There's no licensing body that prevents you from doing that.
Well, they're making these things in their kitchen, protein powders and all that stuff. They're making them in the kitchen. I mean, they really are. I mean, I know people that do that stuff. What do you think about steroids? You don't talk about this in the book, but steroids, human growth hormone. I mean, athletes. I know so many athletes that rely on this stuff. Is this a different topic, or does it fall into the same sort of category?
No, it's the same category. I mean, my son is at college. He's a junior in college, and I walked in, you know, to his roommate, which couldn't have been messier, by the way. And you know, he and his roommate was like a sort of bodybuilder and had just all these huge sort of protein supplements, you know, on the shelf. It was like sort of a pre-kidney disease shelf. That's what it felt like. But I think you have to be really careful with that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the FDA actually is starting to get interested in trying to find some way to crack down on that because it's danger.
You mean even protein powders and things you don't trust?
Yeah. It's actually very simple. Eat foods the way that they were meant to be eaten. Don't take things that are concentrated and assume that that's better for you because it's an unnatural act. As much as it's being sold to you as natural, you should get the combination of proteins, carbohydrates, fats that one typically finds in foods. I mean, eat lots of fruits and vegetables, eat reasonably. But once you start to take these things in pill form, they're not processed and presented in the same manner that you would otherwise. And you can overwhelm yourself with too much in the way of proteins, et cetera. You have to be careful.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about a little something called moderation.
And just common sense.
Yeah.
People take that little gel cap with, you know, that has 3,333% of the recommended daily amounts. You know, you don't need that much.
No, you don't. But what's amazing to me from a human nature point of view is that people don't want to trust a very regulated industry like the pharmaceutical industry. Something about big pharma. And there are problems with big pharma, by the way.
Definitely.
I mean, they are not an ethical group of people. They do some crappy things. And for that, Ben Goldacre also wrote a book called Bad Pharma, and he's pretty good about that. But at least when something like Vioxx comes on the market, you know, which was not a bad drug in many ways, by the way, but it probably killed way less people than did aspirin. But still, there's enough press and there's enough recourse where that company has to make a change. But somehow we trust the vitamin industry. And the people making them are, for the most part, faceless. You don't know who they are.
I think that a perfect story that represents exactly what you said is there was a company, the ironically named Purity First Company of Farmingdale, New York, made a couple things. They made a vitamin C supplement and they made a multi-B supplement, which were taken off the market when it was found that there were women in New York and Connecticut who were starting to develop masculinizing symptoms. They were developing something called hirsutism, which is to say sort of excess hair where you don't want excess hair to be, a deepening of their voice and a change in their menstrual cycles. And so the FDA investigated and found that this vitamin C preparation and this multi-B preparation were contaminated with two powerful anabolic steroids. Now, when that happened, we went to I'm at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia here in Philly, and you know, we went to our shelves to see whether or not we had stocked any of these Purity First products, you know, because we don't control our buyer group. They could have bought that. We could have been giving those products potentially to, you know, to a vulnerable group of hospitalized children.
Sure.
And you know, imagine if amoxicillin were found to be contaminated with anabolic steroids. You'd never hear the end of it. But somehow when this happens, you know, the company gets a free pass. And the CEO, because the company ultimately folded, said, you know, this is just big pharma trying to, you know, sort of, you know, push out the little guy. But you contaminated your vitamin C preparations with anabolic steroids.
Unreal.
Good.
I don't know how they live with themselves. I really don't. They're just bad people to me. But here's the other issue. And talk a little bit about this. You're in a children's hospital. You see, you know, some heartbreaking things, I'm sure. And you also see some, you know, you save a lot of lives. But I think a lot of people are under the impression that when you get cancer, it's probably because our environment is polluted, food is polluted, etc. And then they also feel like, for the most part, when you get cancer, I hear this a lot, if you're a child, if you're an adult, that for the most part, it's a death sentence. They'll cut you up, they'll poison you with chemo, and you die. But aren't a lot of cancers curable? Aren't a lot of childhood cancers curable? Haven't we made great progress against cancer? And when I say curable, I mean you can actually go on to live a very long and fruitful life. Can you talk about
remarkably
that?
Remarkably so. I mean, when I was a younger doctor, I mean, acute lymphocytic leukemia was the death sentence. Not anymore. I mean, 95% of people who have children who have so-called ALL do quite well and live, you know, long, productive lives. Similarly, CML, so-called chronic myelogenous leukemia, was a death sentence. And then Gleevec came about, and it's not. So, sure, I think, I mean, you know, these diseases are all subject to scientific study, and slowly we move forward. There's a great book actually called, the subtitle is The Biography of Cancer, Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee, which really goes through the history of cancer treatment. But, you know, you look back in the 30s and 40s, it was just brutal. And now, you know, there have been many wonderful scientific advances. So, of course, our way forward, our path forward is always going to be with science, not with magic. And I think with this unregulated industry, it's more magic than science.
What about breast cancer and things like that? Again, a lot of it's curable, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, now, you know, you identify receptors on the surface of these cancerous cells. I mean, so you can find out whether it's estrogen receptor positive, and that then puts you in a certain category of drugs or not. And that's, we've made massive strides on breast cancer because we paid for it. You know, I think there's the advocacy groups for breast cancer have been great at getting, you know, the public to support research in that disease.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank God for science. That's all I have to say. It's amazing. And you are on the front lines. I mean, at least you wrote a book about this, you know, and that's why I kind of wanted to get it out there, because we always have sort of the books that I, you know, we do sort of the top five books we recommend. And it's always been pretty, it's exciting that I tour a lot and do a lot of stand up. And I started this podcast because I had a lot of young men surrounding me after my shows, asking me what they should read. And so, you know, I think that the way to beat a bad idea and magic is a bad idea is with a better idea, and that's science. You have to win the day ultimately that way. I think punishment, enforcement is going to – it would suppress it, but they'd find ways around it. So the people just have to be – their minds have to be changed, right?
That's a really good way to put it. I like that.
Yeah.
Get a bad idea with a better idea.
But you also talk about the fact that actually alternative medicine has its place. In a way, or I shouldn't say alternative medicine because you don't like that, but there's the placebo effect, which is very powerful, which you devote a chapter to. Talk a little bit about you know, what the role that magic plays, and there is a role for magic, isn't there?
Yeah, I guess magic is probably not the right word, but when I first wrote this book, the original title of this book was Quacks, How They Hurt Us and Why We Let Them. I saw nothing in this industry that was of value, but I was wrong. I mean, as I look through, and I wish we had a different word than placebo medicine, because I think when people hear the word, they assume it's very dismissive, it's all in your head, there's nothing physiological about it, but that's not true. I mean, I think, you know, when you do things like yoga and you know, the aromatherapy, it's, you know, it's very possible, or massage therapy, that you are, you know, releasing or lessening stress mediators, which can do things like affect your immune system and can do things like affect your blood pressure. And that's all testable. Similarly, I mean, there really is a wonderful literature on how you can learn to do things like release your own endorphins, these sort of pain-relieving chemicals that are made by your hypothalamus and pituitary. Or you can learn to upregulate or downregulate your immune system. You can learn to release your own dopamine. I think that's just remarkable, actually.
Isn't that what acupuncture can do at times?
Yes, acupuncture. With acupuncture, I think you can learn to release your own endorphins. I think it probably has nothing to do with putting needles under the skin. I think simply putting a retractable needle on the skin does the same thing, at least according to those studies by Edzard Ernst and others at University of Exeter. But, you know, and I think it's not really incumbent upon therapists like acupuncturists or chiropractors or naturopaths or homeopaths that when things work, to figure out what it is about why they work. I mean, a homeopathic remedy, obviously, there's nothing in that. So it's not the remedy itself, but it's the perception of the remedy. And that I think, is cool and testable. And I think there is now, you know, there are now studies that are being done to look at that. And that's not something I had actually never anticipated when I first started writing this book. I saw nothing of value here, but I was wrong.
Well, that's pretty cool, because I was surprised that you kind of take Mehmet Oz to task, Deepak Chopra to task, Andrew Weil to task, and these are, you know, I've heard about these guys forever. I mean, Mehmet Oz's show has got some pretty good information in it at times,
and some pretty bad information,
like talking to spirits and the dead, and having a Reiki master in the room with you as you're doing your... I think, by the way? I think the guy's just a really smart businessman and knows that a lot of his patients are super vulnerable or just gullible, or there is a market for that. So when you hear that not only is he a trained surgeon, but he's also got an alternative practitioner in the room, what could it hurt, right? I mean, it's kind of soothing to think of a healer with these really magical hands in your... I think that's what he's doing. I think it's just marketing, man.
Yeah. I think what worries me about that, either Oz or Chopra or Weil, is the guru phenomenon, which is they make it about them. And it should really always be about the data. And I worry, you know, with, I guess, the...
You also said, and I thought it was great, you also say that they provide a manual and an instruction booklet for something where there is no instruction, which is life. They tell you how to eat, how to behave. That's a very powerful thing.
It sort of crosses the line really into religion. I mean, it becomes a, you know, sort of a cultish kind of, you know, faith healing thing that always worries. That stuff always worries me.
And I don't think it'll ever go away. I think human beings need it, but it's very important to put it in its place and to know when it does good and when it does harm. It's knowing the meaningful difference between the two. And if you don't, you're vulnerable, and more tragically and more importantly, your children, small young people, are vulnerable to it, and they can't speak for themselves. And that's what drives me crazy, and that's why this is worth fighting for, and that's why a book like yours is so important. So I thank you for writing it, man. I think you're an important guy. And I think you're a brave guy, and I think you're a good man. And when I'm in Philadelphia, I hope you come to my show, and I'll do the best I can to make you laugh for an hour straight.
Let me know when you're here. I will definitely come. I'll bring my wife and kids. It'll be a great time.
That is a done deal, my friend. Now you've written. Talk about some of the other books you've written before I let you go, and then we'll conclude.
Sure. I wrote, before this book, I wrote a book called Deadly Choices: How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. I wrote a book called Autism's False Prophets: Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and a Search for a Cure, just basically making the point that vaccines don't cause autism. Before that, I wrote a book called Vaccinated: One Man's Quest to Defeat the World's Deadliest Disease, about my hero, a guy named Maurice Hilleman, who was the inventor of 9 of the 14 vaccines we currently give children, and no one knows his name, which just kind of bummed me out.
And saved countless lives, yep.
Yeah. And I'm actually working on a book that'll come out next year called Ungodly Acts: The Clash Between Modern Medicine and Religious Belief.
You're on the front lines, man. You're making a difference. I consider it an honor to be able to talk to somebody like you. So thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you, Brian.
I'll let you know when we're in Philadelphia, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
Sounds great.
Dr. Paul Offit, ladies and gentlemen. The book is called Do You Believe in Magic? So make sure you pick it up. It's important to read, and he's an important guy. You're a good man, sir.
Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
Hey, thank you. I had a good time. Talk to you later.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
It's awesome. That's a good man right there. See, that's a guy who is, look, if you want to buy medicine, you want to buy alternative things, you want to buy alternative medicines, you want to buy supplements, please just ask for the data. There is a way to test whether it works or not. If you eat chocolate cake for a week and try to run a marathon, and then you find that you're tired after mile 3, and then you try to eat yams, grass-fed deer or meat and vegetables and avocados, and somehow, oh look, I can run 26 miles. Do you think maybe that diet is a little better than chocolate cake? That's how we do everything in life. There's nothing wrong with that. And so you can do that with supplements. You can do that with And be aware that sometimes if somebody tells you this is really good and tells you about all the data that you haven't seen, when you take it, sometimes you can feel better. You know why? Because you were told you were going to feel better. Don't discount your own brain. The placebo effect is very powerful, and there's a place for that. But it, don't be ignorant. Don't be ignorant, man. It's, ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance hurts people. It's what's wrong with the world. And the scientific method is one of the reasons you're not burying your children, one of the reasons you don't know a lot of people that died overnight of some weird fever, some weird infection. It's called the scientific method. It's how you prove something is true. It's called empirical evidence, measurable evidence. There's a way to measure whether something works or not. And you should hold yourself accountable to that. That should be the metric for your whole life, in my opinion. I'm writing a script. Why doesn't it work? Why didn't it work for 15 years? And then I read John Truby's book and I go, oh, that's what I was doing wrong. There's a methodology. If you want to be a good stand-up comic, guess how you do it? You just keep getting up and telling jokes and writing, and they don't work, and then they do work. And now you know they work. The audience laughs. So no supplement's going to help me with that. So, you know, just be aware that there's a way to test these things, man. And understand that the vitamin industry, like any industry, there are people in those industries that are unscrupulous, that gain a great deal from pushing something on you. And they're not concerned with your health. They're concerned with their own pocketbook. And if you don't know that, if you don't ask for the data, if you don't ask to see why this works, you tell me this works, why? How? I want to know how and why. If you don't do that, then you're a sheep. Then you're at risk of being taken advantage of, and probably should be taken advantage of. How about that? If you listen to Jenny McCarthy, who's not a bad person, but if you listen to an actress or whatever she is, then that's on you, man. That's on you. And I know she had her doctors, and I know she was on Oprah. And whenever you see all that sparkle and flash, it's really easy to buy into it. It doesn't mean you're dumb. It's very easy to go, maybe there is something to this. I did it. I didn't want to vaccinate my dog at one point. I was like, well, maybe there's something to this. There's a lot of noise over here. There's a lot of noise for a reason. No. Don't confuse that. Just see what science is saying. There isn't one body, not one public health body in any country that I know of that endorses supplements, taking vitamins. Why? Why? Is it because they're all bad? Is it because it's a huge conspiracy? Is it because the pharmaceutical industry is that powerful? I don't think that. I don't think so. I think that's very cynical. There are a lot of good people like Paul Offit who are writing and looking at evidence. They don't, you know, this. He didn't write a book because he was going to make millions of dollars on that book, okay? He wrote a book because he lives it, and he's like, this is not cool. I got to get the truth out there. God bless scientists. Read the book, man. It's really, really good. We didn't get a chance to talk to Linus Pauling about Linus Pauling, but Linus Pauling is the guy who won two Nobel Prizes, who decided along the way that vitamin C cures everything, including the common cold. And that's why when you have a common cold, we all take vitamin C. Guess what? There isn't a shred of evidence, not a shred of measurable data to suggest that taking vitamin C helps alleviate, shorten, or anything else a common cold. Doesn't do a thing. Thank you for listening to the Brian Callen Show. Oh, by the way, where am I going to be? I'll be at the Calusa Casino, I think on the 2nd of May, and then I'll be in Edmonton, and then I'll be in Toronto. Peace!
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.